Good morning to my frozen colleagues on the committee today. I think this is probably the worst that it's been in terms of the cold air. Representative Keel, several years ago, and Representative Erickson will confirm this. Yeah, this room actually used to be even colder than this. It was pretty bad. You walk out of here actually with cold feet because obviously it was very cold on the floor. So I have no idea what's going on, but, you know, it was like this last night as well. So hopefully we'll have a nice heated conversation. That'll warm up a little bit. So,
Mr. Chair, there isn't a fan switch on that little thermostat up there, is there?
Peter already checked, it looks like. Yeah. All right. So we've sent a page over to the supply to see what they can do about it. All right, members, we do have a minute. We do have a quorum. And we do have minutes for March 19th, and I'm looking for someone to move adoption of the minutes. Thank you. Representative Barrett moves adoption of the minutes of March 19th. Discussion? If not, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you. Members, we have two items today. We have Representative Winkler's bill, House File 336. And I'm told that Representative Winkler has been practicing this so that we can get it out of here pretty quick, hopefully. And then we're going to have a discussion with the legislative auditor relative to the special education report that they issued not too long ago. So with that, Representative Winkler, you're up first. And Representative Winkler, I will move your bill, House File 336, be recommended to pass, and we are going where?
K-12 Finance.
Very well. So that'll be my motion. House File 336 be recommended to pass and refer to Education Finance. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the topic of conversation will switch from cold air to hungry children, if anything, possibly more bleak.
Yes.
This bill was brought to me by some constituents and other folks who are engaged in a hunger project called Mazone, which is part of a larger national hunger project. Judy Tannenbaum is the local co-chair. She has more information. But they looked at hunger issues in Minnesota and discovered some information and I think disturbing stories about students on the reduced lunch program. So we talk about free and reduced, but there are a lot of kids who are on the reduced lunch program who have to pay, and if they don't have money from their families when they get to school for the copay, the 40-cent copay, in some cases they've been turned away or given different food from other children, and it's really kind of a travesty that we're creating this kind of second class for these students. The bill, and this is not a finance committee, Mr. Chair, but the bill costs $3.5 million a year for the state of Minnesota to cover the cost of lunch for all of the reduced fee lunch students in the state. And I guess from an education policy standpoint, the issue here is whether it's good to have all kids get a nutritious lunch and breakfast if needed or not. And we don't have to make the final decisions about financing. But I do have somebody who'd like to testify, if you will permit the time.
Of course. Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid, and I'll be very brief, but where this originally came from, about 5 to 6 years ago, Legal Aid found out that there were children being turned away from lunch counters or being given cheese sandwiches. We came up to the legislature. We met with as many people as we could, and frankly, legislators just didn't believe us. They didn't hear about it in their districts. They couldn't believe that lunch staff would be so cruel as to scrape a child's lunch into the trash, as we had had stories of, or turn a child away with nothing, turn an 8-year-old away with nothing. And so what we did is we partnered with 4 private law firms downtown Minneapolis to survey as many school districts as they could, and they got to about half of our school districts. And what they found out through their research was that about 20% of our school districts have a policy of turning a child away with nothing when they show up to the lunch counter and don't have money for lunch. So Legal Aid has been advocating a bill that is just a straight policy bill that says you just can't turn a child away with nothing. It's very unpopular. It's seen as an unfunded mandate. School districts don't want to have to absorb the costs, so that's why we're thankful that Representative Winkler and others have brought forward legislation to fund lunch for these children. The only other thing I'll say is that this research showed was that there were some really ugly practices beyond turning children away. Some of the stigmatizing practices that Representative Winkler mentioned, some of them were giving children red or purple tickets, making them wear rubber bands on their arms, stamping their hands, sending them to the back of the kitchen to get a brown bag, and then describing this as a deterrence practice that they'd have to walk through the kitchen and walk through the line past all of their friends. And when people see that brown bag with the cheese sandwich, they know that that child doesn't have money for lunch. And so there's these other deterrence practices staff described to try to stop children from showing up without money. That was also disturbing to us. So we hope that this can be addressed to the session. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Webster. Do we have questions for Ms. Webster? You might want to stay there for a second. Representative Erickson, I may want to borrow those gloves myself later. It's awfully cold here. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm making a statement because I could not sit underneath that vent one more day and get a tight muscle. So I'm going to wear my coat, my scarf, and my gloves. Ms. Webster, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Webster, do you have documentation of those examples that have occurred in school districts, or is this anecdotal? Could you provide us with that answer?
Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson, we do have documentation of the school districts, and I can provide that to the committee. We provided it in finance in packets there, and I didn't bring it today. Thank you.
And Ms. Webster, that refers to a conversation or a discussion that was had in finance committee generally on this issue. There have been several bills introduced, Representative Winkler, on this issue, all with different kind of approaches. And for some reason, you know, some bills came here and some bills went to finance. I don't quite know, you know, what the logic of that is, but it would certainly be my hope that if the committee is favorable here, that we be able to get all those bills in one place in one committee so that they can have the options before them. As they make a determination about both appropriations and what appropriate policy supports those appropriations in that committee. Otherwise, you know, we've got two committees potentially going in two different directions. Representative Crucia.
Thank you, Chair Mariani, and thank you, Ms. Webster, for your testimony. Just a couple of questions because we are a policy committee. You mentioned 20% of the districts that you surveyed have policy regarding this and turning kids away. Are we addressing the policy or the practice here today with this bill?
Ms. Webster.
Mr. Chair, Representative, this bill that you're looking at would fund all children that are in the reduced price lunch category, would give those children free lunch. So it would, in my view, it would end all of these practices, and it would end the practices and it would end the policy for these children. For children who are above 185% of poverty, school districts would still be allowed to turn children away.
Representative Frisch.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. So we're going to discriminate between those parents who have not paid the account and those who have free and reduced onto which ones can be turned away?
Ms. Webster.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, so these children are from 130% of poverty to 185% of poverty. And while I wish that we could have universal free lunch or fund lunch for all of these children, I've been told there are finite resources. And so we had to make a cutoff. And if you look at why this is the cutoff, these children, when they're babies, they're WIC babies. So we thought that they are reduced price lunch category. That's where the federal government has drawn the cutoff. So as expanding, if you're expanding free lunch to the next kind of neediest group of children, these are the neediest group of children.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crisha, I mean, I think your point is a fair one, and that is whether we should just have I mean, it gets to be difficult, right, if we're going to the state start to say that you can never, I would say they should never tell a child they can't eat lunch. But I'm not sure we want to put that in state law either. And I think the issue is if the districts have a financial concern with the reduced price lunch kids not paying, and that's a mandate that they have to eat, then I can understand why the money would be necessary. I think a broader question of how districts deal with parents who have the money but, you know, are late in getting the money in or something like that. My sense is that they probably just sort of work with those families. But the fact that they have done a survey and determined that kids on reduced price lunch are being, I think, stigmatized, and they're the kids who are going to feel more stigmatized if they have to have a different kind of, you know, go to the back of the kitchen to get their lunch or have to wear a rubber band or do things like that. They're the ones who are going to feel like they're being treated differently. Probably not the kids whose parent, whose families have the money, but simply are late in getting in. We've been late in getting it in at our house, and, you know, our kids still get to eat at school. So I assume that that's generally the practice.
And just to follow up,
Representative Cresci.
And I appreciate that, Representative Winkland. So I'm trying to address, and this is the concerns I have. I mean, let's take the emotional side out. We certainly don't want to stigmatize children, and we want to address this. I get that. I've worked with free and reduced lunches. I've worked with this. I understand the problem. And so when I look at your 20% and the policy and our kids being turned away, have we determined, and I've been late on my lunch payments too with my kids, is this a kid whose parents inadvertently missed it, or the parents who aren't paying, because there are parents who can pay and aren't, or is it a free and reduced parent, or is it a free and reduced parent who refuses to pay because they, I mean, there's a lot there, and I think this bill is going to cause more stigmatizing and more problems because there's the possibility that one student comes through, and because they're on the free and reduced, and they get their meal, and then another student who comes through, and their parents just didn't pay the bill, but we're still allowing to pull their trays, scrape in the trash, which is a really bad situation. But kids are pretty bright. And the students are over there going, oh, how come the kid that's on the free and reduced gets their meal, but this one doesn't? I mean, we're creating a situation, I think, or exacerbating the very problem we're trying to solve.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair and Representative Cresci, I think the approach may not be one that resolves this issue in its entirety, but I think the problem primarily lies with families who simply don't have very much money, and their kids are either not getting fed or they're being treated differently in school. And we already have a policy in place to provide free lunch for lots of kids, and this is really a fairly small difference to make to simplify the program, so we're not creating, you know, the reduced price lunch, which frankly I'm not even sure what great value that provides anyway. I mean, obviously it's cheaper, but I don't know why we would have to distinguish between those two things. And so from a policy point of view, simplifying the system, making sure that kids who are still from pretty low-income families are going to be able to get lunches without worrying about whether they can afford that 40 cents on a daily basis. At least that, I think, solves a bigger part of the problem, even if we're not addressing everything. And I'm not sure, frankly, what the legislature can do to address this, the kids whose families, you know, from middle-class families whose parents forget. I'm not sure what we can do about that. But at least to the extent that it's a financial problem, we can resolve it.
Representative Cresci.
And thank you, Representative Winkler. And one of the things that you and I have talked offline sometimes, I appreciate the way you look at these problems. And I think in one way we both agree here. This is a situation that legislatively we're not going to solve all the iterations of it. And I wonder if it's not a better policy to, rather than earmark this, micromanage schools a little bit and exacerbate the problem a bit, then increase funding across the board in this area and let schools decide. Because, I mean, I can't believe that schools are intentionally trying to make their kids into bad situations. As a former teacher, and that's just not how you operate. I realize bad things happen. There's perceptions that come about. But this, to me, seems like we're getting a little bit too far down in the weeds and micromanaging when we should be really letting our schools know, don't do this to your kids. Find ways to help them. I know many times that I had put money in the lunch accounts for students that were really, because I knew the family situation. But sitting here 140 miles away from the districts that are going to be affected, they need to be able to make those decisions, not me. So that's just where I'm looking at a policy, and I'm trying really hard to stay away from the financial aspect of it. But
Mr. Chair, Representative Cresci, I understand, and it's my understanding that there are also bills out there to increase the amount of funding for school lunches. Generally, the legal aid said that they have a bill just to prohibit charging students from free to reduced lunch. And you know, so I think all of these things are kind of part of the mix, potentially, in the finance bill. You know, I guess I just think that the policy idea here is we can simplify a program and get rid of this interim step of the reduced price lunch and just either make it free or full pay instead of having this in-between step, which still can trip up a lot of kids from families of low income.
And thank you, Chairman. And so thank you, Representative Winkler. Follow up on that. So now I have to ask the question, is the policy about the free and reduced program or is it about the stigmatism of a child that gets turned away? Which policy are we addressing now?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Winkler.
And I don't mean to be. These are great questions. And
yes.
Yes?
Yes.
Okay. Are you a lawyer? Okay, so that's what I'm trying to...
Yes.
I know. So, then I have to... Then the question that I have to ask, or at least that I would ask us to think about, is what unintended consequence do we... What will this policy do to somebody who has to make a decision in a lunch line between student A and student B, depending on their situation? Mom and Dad didn't fund my account. Mom and Dad can't afford to fund my account. It seems like we're going to treat those two students differently and force a, for lack of better words, but a lunch worker to make a very bad decision because of policy. And that concerns me. So,
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Preach, I actually don't think we're forcing that decision. What the bill really just does is eliminate the reduced lunch fee, so they can eat just like the kids who get the free lunch. And if, you know, we know that there are some issues that Legal Aid has identified that relate to the reduced fee lunch program, and this would resolve it by basically getting rid of that interim step. And I, you know, I'm to your point, I have to agree, I'm not sure that we can insist that everybody in the state make good judgment and decide that it's better for a kid to eat lunch than it is to worry about, you know, anything about, you know, the particular financial situation of that kid at that time. But the bill does not prohibit the schools from giving everybody the lunch. Mm-hmm. It just says that we're going to pay for the reduced fee lunches where we know there's a problem.
Representative Christian.
Thank you, Chair Marianne. Thank you, Representative Wiener. So my final summation is I look at, I guess the challenge, because I agree with you, and I think rather than earmarking this, micromanaging, let's let the schools make those decisions, let's find, rather than supplanting the parents' obligations, let's, because a lot of schools are just writing this off. They're handling this. And again, my concern would be, and I understand where you're going with the free and reduce, but a free and reduce qualifying student will get their lunch. The same a student, same situation, mom and dad didn't pay for it, the school policy would pull their lunch. And we haven't broadly addressed the fact that we want kids well fed and doing well in the classroom. And so that's just my concerns. I've just thrown them out.
Very well. Members, we have several members have questions, but I think there's also other testifiers here. So, Ms. Webster, I don't want you to wander too far. Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, if I could just have a testifier give just a brief presentation.
Good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you very much for the opportunity to address you this morning. My name is Judith Tenenbaum, and I'm here on behalf of Mazon, a Jewish response to hunger. Mazon is a national organization, many years old. It's made up to $61 million in grants to combat hunger across the United States. Some of these grants have been made here in Minnesota, particularly to Food Shelf, Second Harvest, and actually Minnesota Legal Aid. And we have been very concerned about the problem of school lunches. This is a project that's housed at the Adath Yeshurun Synagogue in Minnetonka. Our rabbi there, Rabbi Harold Kravitz, is the board chair, the national board chair of Mazon, and that's one reason this is happening here in Minnesota. But there are similar projects across the country to address serious issues of hunger state by state. I want to say that we appreciate the discussion that's taking place here today. We are not sure of the exact right solution for this. We appreciate their, you know, Representative Winkler's bill in this discussion, but we do think this is a very important issue that needs to be addressed. And Mark Miazga is going to tell you why we think it's such an important issue. Thank you,
Ms. Tannenbaum. Mr. Miazga.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mark Miazga. I'm a health research coordinator at the University of Minnesota, and I just want to briefly talk about children and hunger in my remarks. The research across the country and in the research done here at in Minnesota, and particularly at the University of Minnesota, is conclusive. Hungry children are more likely to be sick. They're more likely to have a more severe type of illness and to be sicker for longer periods of time. They miss more school. They're more likely to struggle with mental illness and emotional problems, and they're far more likely to be suspended from school than their peers. In addition, they're more likely to repeat a grade and not only fall behind their peers physically and socially, but also cognitively as well, setting them up for a pretty tough adulthood. I was planning to talk about the economic costs of hunger as well, but in the interest of brevity, I won't touch on that. Suffice it to say, these children cost both law enforcement systems and school districts a lot more money, and we're already paying for that now. We could cut back on those costs by addressing those issues with this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miazga. Representative Winkler, do you have other testifiers? So here's what I want to do. I think there's some others in the audience that want to testify. I suspect against the bill. I want to hear that. If there are such testifiers, then we'll get back to the question. We have about three members that still have questions here. Is there anyone? Thank you, Mr. Miazga. Don't wander too far now. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on the bill? Perhaps not. Very well. So then we do have questions, Representative Keel and Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, in that study that was she mentioned examining the schools, you said, I thought you said half of the schools got examined. So how many, were there rural schools involved in that also?
Ms. Webster.
Mr. Chair, Representative Keel, yes, it was urban, suburban, rural. It was statistically, it was a broad sampling of school districts. And when I didn't know if you wanted me to go into the details of this study today because I thought you were looking for brevity, but the sometimes it wasn't a school district-wide policy. We found that sometimes it was school by school within a district, or even principal by principal, or sometimes even lunch staff by lunch staff. We know that some lunch staff were digging into their own pockets and paying for these kids, even when their school district was supposed to be, or their school was supposed to be turning kids away. So it really varies.
Representative Keel.
Okay, thanks. Having been on a school board and coming down on people who weren't paying, we went to a program that I can't remember the name of. It was automatic pay. You could do it, and you could get emails, and we decided that we would credit every child $5. We did some adaptive things in the grade schools, not wanting to cause, not having them eating. But this is personal experience. I handed my children a certain amount of money. We agreed on it, and it was in their account, and they were supposed to pay it. Their lunch every day, whether we did this program or earlier when my older children were there, that was theirs. And if they ran out, they went hungry. My daughter, and they rarely did it. They did it once, and then they learned. But I have a daughter who did this with a friend, and she said, "Well, Mom, she doesn't have money." And this is where I'm going with this. I'm really concerned. I agree with Representative Kreisha on, what are we doing here? Because the idea in high school especially is to teach these children some a responsibility, that they need to self-sufficiency and they need to be responsible for what they're doing. And anyway, my daughter shared her lunch. What a wonderful girl. She let her charge on her account every day, ran out of money halfway through the month, came to me and said, "Mom, what am I going to do?" And then she said, "Well, so-and-so doesn't have any money." And I went, "Oh, there's something not right with this." Turned out that her mother, the other girl's mother, was doing the same thing, and this girl was taking her lunch money and purchasing other things with it. This is before the automatic $5, the program, and which helps parents control that part of it. But I guess, I understand that there's problems, although I don't believe in my rural schools there's any children. We provided a peanut butter sandwich and those kinds of things if they didn't have it. And I believe it was a peanut butter sandwich and apple and milk. And I know teachers that have said they felt bad about that. And I guess some kids like peanut butter sandwiches, so I don't know why we're ostracizing that. But I really have some concerns about controlling schools from this area. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Barrett.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have a question for the author, but first I want to relay a story, and it's related to Representative Kreisch's thoughts about stigma. You know, for me, I grew up South Dakota, and my mom was the primary breadwinner in her family, the only breadwinner. I worked 70 hours a week, supporting four kids, and so we got free lunch growing up, which was fine. But after a while, we have punch cards. There's 20 punches on each card. I don't know how they do it now, if it's electronic or what. But there's a point in my life where the stigma of having that 20th punch be done, and then the next day, I know that card would be there, and I wouldn't give them a check. So in my mind, there was huge stigma, regardless of what the school did. The school didn't put a green button on me. They didn't make me go to the kitchen. But I knew it. So I'm a little worried that we're trying to alleviate something that kids in their growing mind are going to have anyway. I mean, nobody probably thought that I got free lunch. I don't know if they did. I knew. So in high school, I went home for lunch every day. Did not eat lunch at school one day in high school because I couldn't get over the stigma of getting the free lunch. Now, I tell my kids I walked 8 blocks uphill both ways is what I'd tell them. But it's true, about 8 blocks every day for lunch. And I don't know how much I spent at home. Probably ate a pizza or whatnot. Probably spent a lot more than the 40 cents that, or whatever it is that it would have cost at school. But the issue, I mean, the green buttons and the wristbands, that's just mean. That's not stigma. That's mean. That's wrong. I mean, that's not. Stigma comes personally, internally, I think, in many cases. But the question I have is unrelated to that, but... is there any unintended consequence, Representative Winkler, to kind of eliminating the reduced lunch as it relates to compensatory revenue? I mean, I'm just thinking as we create laws over time, they kind of have an unintended consequence after a while. So that, you know, we give certain money to school districts based on free lunches, based on reduced, not for lunches, but just because we feel that, you know, we need more money for that type of student. Is there any risk in your mind to doing this and then having unintended consequences as it relates to the money going to free and reduced to compensatory revenue?
Representative Barrett, I don't think so because we're not eliminating the category. We're just paying for the copay. So the money's coming from the state to the local district to pay the share of that copay. We're not eliminating the concept. We're just covering the money.
Quick follow-up. I think after time, though, school districts have less need to segregate free lunches from reduced lunches. So over time, I'm just wondering if that concept will disappear because there's no need to capture it.
Representative Benson, and then we'll vote. We still want to hear from the legislative auditor.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. My first bill here in the House of Representatives was to carry increase in funding for school lunches, and I remember there was a little stigma attached to me because the amount we were asking for, I think it was 1.5 cents. I was called the 1.5 cent legislator here for a couple of years, so I carried a little stigma, but I was very proud of having authored that bill. And just yesterday I had a constituent who is an immigrant moved to this country about 5 or 6 years ago. And during our discussion, I asked him, I said, well, when you came here, thinking about America, he was from the Middle East, this person, what was the biggest surprise for you? And he said, the biggest surprise for me was that we always saw America as this tremendous democracy and a very, very rich country. And I was blown away to find out how many hungry people there are in this country. I did not expect that at all. And, you know, Mr. Chair, I wish we had an opportunity in this committee and others to discuss the whole issue of why is it in a country this wealthy we have millions of people, including millions of children, who go to bed every day hungry. There's something wrong with the social contract in this society, in my opinion. And I just wanted to say that regardless of whether we are removing stigmas, adding stigmas, or stigmas are remaining, unless we're prepared to begin permitting people to have children, we need to focus on the children and what's happening with them and whether they're going to school and to class hungry. And I spent 30-some years in the classroom, and I can tell you, Mr. Chair, from the 7th grade all the way through the senior high, if there are young people, for whatever reason, were in my classroom and were hungry, the opportunity for learning was very greatly diminished. So please accept my frustration with why we're quibbling about something like this. The issue is hungry children. I don't give a damn, excuse it, why they are. They need to be fed in any civilized society. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Members, that's it for questions. Are we ready to vote?
Mr. Chair, I just also like...
Representative Winkler, I'm sorry.
No, one final comment, which is, you know, I think there's a difference between kids missing a meal every once in a while because they're, you know, in high school and they're, you know, sort of not learning some personal responsibility, or from families that forget and something happens. But what we're talking about in this bill are people from families who are much more likely to miss more than the occasional meal at school because of their poverty. And so that's why I think we can draw a difference and support a concept like this.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Winkler. Members? Representative Morgan?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to request a roll call on this vote.
A roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Mariani?
Aye.
Representative Beinert?
Yes.
Representative Sandra Erickson?
Yes.
Representative Anderson? Is excused. Representative Barrett?
Yes.
Representative Benson?
Yes.
Representative Bai?
Yes.
Representative Dabney? Is excused. Representative Roger Erickson?
Yes.
Representative Faust?
Yes.
Representative Isaacson? Is excused. Representative Keel?
Yes.
Representative Kreisha?
Yes.
Representative Weidiger?
Yes.
Representative Marquardt?
Yes.
Representative Morgan?
Yes.
Representative Nornes?
Yes.
Representative Sawatsky?
Yes.
Representative Erdahl?
Yes.
Representative Wills?
Yes.
Representative Yaruso?
Yes.
And very quickly, Representative Anderson? Is excused. Representative Dabney? Excused. Representative Isaacson? Is excused.
Very well. Representative Marquardt, you have a strong message from this committee on a vote of 18 ayes to 0 nays. The motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the good discussion, committee members.
Members, we'll spend the rest of our time this morning with the legislative auditor. We're going to have an informational hearing on the recent report of the Office of Legislative Auditor on Special Education. There was a sharing of this report in our K-12 Finance Committee a few weeks ago, but many of our members do not serve on that committee, and this is an issue, of course, of high importance in our public education system and of high importance to these committee members. We've actually acted on several special ed provisions over the course of the last several weeks, and we were occasionally referencing the report as we acted, and so I thought it would be a really good idea to circle back and hear from the auditor at this point. So, good morning. Welcome to the committee. We're looking forward to the information sharing this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and with me at the table is Jody Hauer.
who was the manager of the evaluation of special education. And Mr. Chairman, thank you for giving us this opportunity to present and discuss with you this report. I think we all understand, and certainly people on this committee do, that special education presents us with important opportunities to help students with special needs. We provide that help not only because it is our legal obligation to do so, but also because the extra effort may mean that special education students will be more successful in school and their families will be better able to meet the challenges that come with raising a special needs child. Sometimes the help that we provide in special education is just a little, but sometimes it is a lot. Sometimes things go smoothly, but sometimes they do not. Sometimes there is agreement between the family and the school about what services are needed and how they will be provided. But sometimes there is conflict and controversy. Sometimes the costs involved are minimal, but sometimes the costs are enormous. As you know, issues related to special education are complex and they are persistent. And there are no simple solutions. But I am hopeful, Mr. Chairman, that the report that Ms. Hauer and her team has put together will provide you with additional information about the challenges and opportunities in special education and help us design a path towards some improvements, towards better cost control, and specifically a more systematic assessment of the costs and benefits of the state of Minnesota going beyond what is required by federal law and federal rules. So, Mr. Chairman, again, I want to thank you for this time that you've provided to us, and I want to turn to Ms. Hauer for a presentation of our findings and recommendations.
Very well. Thank you. Good morning, Ms. Hauer. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jody Hauer. I'm with the Office of the Legislative Auditor, and I will be going over the specifics of our report in this presentation. I'm going to start, though, with an overview of what our major findings were, and I'll go into a bit of detail on each one of them, followed with an explanation of what we recommend.
And Ms. Hauer, I think the way I would like to do this is, and there's always a risk of this because we may not get all the way through, but is to allow some flexibility for members if there's something in particular that they want to ask as you go through, that we have that conversation. So members, just so you know, you've got some permission, but also obviously we want to try to get through the full report as well. So please, okay. Ms. Hauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the overview is first related to funding, that we found in the funding of special education, the school districts have had to divert some of their general education revenues to pay for special education costs. And second, the majority of revenues for special education do come from the state, with a significant share from local school district resources and a smaller share from the federal government. Third, we found that the funding arrangements for special education contain some disincentives for cost controls. Fourth, many provisions in our state laws and rules exceed those in federal requirements. Fifth, our Minnesota Department of Education is required to ensure that all the school districts around the state comply with the legal requirements, and the department does have a compliance monitoring process to ensure that, but this process has proven to be confusing to some of the teachers and special education directors in different parts of the state. And finally, the number of students receiving special education in Minnesota has grown steadily. Now, as I said, I'm going to go through each one of these. I'm going to start, though, by giving a bit of explanation of what we found to be some of the characteristics of the student population that receives special education. So, in terms of the number of students, this slide shows how the number of students receiving special education has changed over the last 12 years. For the 2010-2011 school year, we had nearly 112,000 students around the state receiving special education. This represents an increase of 11% in the number of students receiving special education since the 1999-2000 school year, so 12-year period. We contrasted that with the number of total K-12 students, and what we saw is a decrease in that same time period for the total K-12 education population. So at the same time we saw an increase in the number of students receiving special education, we saw a decrease in the total number of students in K-12 overall. students who qualify for special education may have multiple disabilities, but each one of them is assigned a primary disability and then grouped into one of 13 disability categories.
Ms. Power, I'm going to interrupt very quickly. Representative Barrett has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. Do you have that number? Special ed kids have gone up 11%. Population's gone down by 3%. Do you have that information by school district?
Ms. Power.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we do have that data in our back in our data bases. I don't have that in the report, but if that's something that you would like, we can certainly provide it.
Thank you. I would, yes.
Perfect. Thank you, Ms. Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the disability categories, you'll see the top five in this particular slide where we show how the numbers have changed over that, again, that 12-year period. You see, if you look at that first row, that the number of students who are in the category of specific learning disabilities is the largest slice of the total pie of students receiving special education, but that segment of the total pie has actually decreased over that 12 years. And by contrast, the fifth line there shows autism spectrum disorders, and that showed over that 12-year period one of the largest rate of increases, over 500% growth in that category of autism spectrum disorders. There was one other category that saw an even larger rate of increase, over 600%, for children who were in the category of severely multiply disabled. But that whole category comprises just a much smaller number, so it doesn't fit on this particular slide, only about 1,000 students total. However, we do have in the full report, if anyone's interested, on page 21, we have an exhibit that does show for each one of the 13 categories what the total number is and how that's changed over time.
Ms. Howard, and I knew this one would generate a question, as it did in finance as well. We do have a question from Representative Roger Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at line 5 on autism spectrum disorders, I'm just wondering if there's an explanation. Are we identifying more or less severely autistic and putting them in this category? Are there that many more coming through? That seems to be an amazingly high percentage. Is there an explanation? Has anybody looked at that statistic? And is there an explanation?
Ms. Holland.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, and what you were describing is really the explanation. That is, we have now, the medical community has now in place much more rigorous and accurate ways of identifying what the autism spectrum disorder consists of, and so there has been a great improvement in the ability of medical practitioners to identify autism disorder in children over the years, and so that certainly has contributed to what we see as this dramatic increase. We also think and speculate that the decrease that we saw in row one in the learning disabilities area may have something to do with the increase in the autism spectrum disorders category. That is, that some children who probably 15 years ago may have been labeled to have a learning disability have now, because of the more precise way of detecting and evaluating children who have the autism spectrum disorders, would now be in that category that has grown so much. So it's a combination of factors, some of which, probably a great deal of which, has to do with the better ways of detecting and measuring what now constitutes the autism spectrum disorder.
Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You just answered part of the question, but wouldn't that also affect some of the other categories, because some students that may have been identified primarily as having speech or language impairment or emotional or behavioral disorders may also now be diagnosed with autism spectrum disorders?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, indeed. And, of course, as I said, there's 13 total different categories of disability, and any one of those probably could have included some children who now are more accurately determined to have autism spectrum disorder. The exact percentage for which that might explain the difference, we don't know.
Representative Everton, I apologize. I think you had a follow-up to your question.
Yeah, just one quick question. Would that also, if you go back up to slide 3, the 11% increase, would that be a driving factor in that number also?
Ms. Howard.
Mr. Chair and Representative, it certainly could. You do see, if you look at that slide, that there is not only the fact that the total population of K-12 students has gone down, but there's been an increase in just the number of children who have been identified and then evaluated to have a disability. So we have more children now that have been identified as eligible for special education. So some of that certainly may be accounted for by what you described earlier, Representative, as sort of improved mechanisms for identifying what these disabilities are and then evaluating children who have them.
Very well. Please continue, Ms. Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to move on to how we looked at students in terms of the instructional setting in which they have received their education. Right now, children who receive special education are assigned to an instructional setting based on the amount of time they spend within their school day inside the general education classroom. So children who spend 80% or more of their day with their peers who are non-disabled in the general education classroom are said to be in setting one. And this is a significant thing because federal law does require that school districts provide to children receiving special education the maximum amount appropriate of time in the least restrictive setting, or the setting one. This table on the slide shows that most students receiving special education were in that setting one category. 61% in 2010-2011 of all the children in Minnesota receiving special education were in that least restrictive setting, setting one. So that is, they were with their non-disabled peers in the general education classroom for most or all of their day. The rest of the slide breaks it down by the different instructional settings. I won't go through each one of them row by row. Just wanted to show to you that over time there was, over the 12-year period we looked at, there was a slight reduction in the share of students receiving special education who were in that setting one, and slight increases in the setting two and setting three instructional settings. I'm going to talk now about funding for special education. As you know, the revenues for special education are substantial and they have been growing. We found that in fiscal year 2011, revenues for special education totaled $1.8 billion, and that's a 3% increase over the prior year. We then looked at revenues over time. We adjusted them for inflation so that they were all in 2011 dollars, and we saw that since 2000, revenues had increased over $500 million, and that equated to about a 38% increase over this 12-year period. Now, the sources of revenue for special education, as I mentioned at the outset, come from the state largely, also from local school district resources, and also from federal sources, although the federal source is the smallest, and that's what this next slide does describe. The top line here, the one in red.
I'm sorry, I'll interrupt again. Representative Leidinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A quick question just for clarification. The total number of K-12 students, and I'm back on slide three, you don't need to go back there. Does that include private schools, homeschools? Is that a total number of students in the state, or is this just the public school children, please? As we're going through this, we're kind of talking over here, and that was one of the questions.
Good question,
Representative. Mr. Chair, Representative.
Ms. Howard.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's the total K-12 education population, so that is going to include the children who are attending private schools as well as public schools.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Howard, please continue.
So, Mr. Chair, back on the slide related to revenues, the red line on this slide represents the state portion, and that indicates a total of the dedicated special education revenues as well as a portion of the general education revenues that follow special education students wherever they might be receiving their education. And you can see over time there was some fluctuation, but over that 12-year period it was a median 56% of total revenues. The green line, the middle line, shows the portion from local school districts. This green line consists of an additional portion of general education revenue, as well as for most of these, for many districts, revenue that came from local operating referenda. This line is also what has come to be known as the cross subsidy, and in the simplest of terms, trying to understand what that is, it's the amount that's not reimbursed by the state or by the federal dedicated sources, but that school districts have to pay for out of their own resources. The yellow line, of course, the bottom line, is the federal portion. Again, over that 12-year period, The median point was about 11%. You do see an uptick in 2010, 2011, but at no point was, over this 12-year period, was the federal share more than 16% of the total revenues for special education. I want to talk a bit more about the school district.
If I may, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I don't think you gave the median for the state share. What was that, please?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Representative, the median over that period was 56% for the state, 33% for the local.
And 33, that's
what I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, 33.
Yes.
Ms. Hauer, as we were, I was chatting here with my committee administrator, as we were looking at that last slide where we had that kind of unusual little bump toward the end, we were speculating that might have to do with the stimulus monies that were targeted for special ed.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's precisely the reason why the federal portion went up for those years, because of the stimulus money that the federal government had provided for a variety of purposes, obviously, but also for special education.
Very well. Please continue. Thank you.
So regarding the school district cross-subsidy, Mr. Chair, members, the school district cross-subsidy has been significant. It amounted to $572 million in fiscal year 2011. We look at that over time. We adjusted it for inflation, and we saw that it was a 40% increase since the year 2000, when the cross-subsidy was about $409 million. Now, school districts voiced concerns about the cross-subsidy because they're forced to divert their general education revenues to pay for special education expenditures instead of paying for other needs that they have that would affect their entire school district population, such as lowering class sizes. We also found that the distribution of the cross-subsidy burden varies substantially around the state. The state average back in 2011 was $631 per student of cross-subsidy. So $631 was the state average, but we had some districts that were as low as $100 per student and some that were over $1,000 per student in cross-subsidy. We also found that the larger school districts and those in the metropolitan area, as well as the regional centers around the state, St. Cloud, Duluth, Rochester, tended to have the largest cross-subsidy burden per student. And we do have an exhibit in the full report on, that would show to you on page 51, if you're interested, what the top 25 school districts are in terms of the cross-subsidy. We also found
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering, Do you have any statistics as to the percentages of special ed students in school districts? I mean, is there a variance? Are there a greater number, for example, in Greater Minnesota than in larger school districts? Or is there a percentage difference?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, there is, of course, variation, quite a bit of variation by district. But we looked at the subsidy on a per student basis, so it's on an average per student, and that takes out the what would otherwise be seen as a large variation from district to district. We did also look at just the total cost subsidy, and you saw differences there, but we also wanted to see what it was on a per student basis, and that's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about the difference in the cross-subsidy burden. On a per student basis, we saw that great range from $100 per student in some of the smaller districts up to over $1,000 per student in others.
Ms. Fowler.
Mr. Chair, talking about the funding system, we also identified a number of disincentives that we believe hinder school districts' attempt to control costs for special education. One of these is that, decades ago now, the federal courts have found that children with disabilities have a constitutional right to a public education, regardless of their disabilities. So when services are identified as necessary for that student in the individualized education program that is built for that student, school districts have to pay for them. A school district cannot refuse to provide services to a student with disabilities. Second disincentive is that in Minnesota, the school districts where the students reside, so the resident district, have the responsibility to pay for the portion of those students' special education needs that is not reimbursed by the state, even if those students attend a school outside of where they live. So if they use the open enrollment option or if they attend a charter school outside of the residential district, that, that the district where they reside is still responsible for that portion of the expenses that the state does not reimburse. But the resident district has very little control over what that spending is on the student who is being educated in the district outside of the resident district. Then the third disincentive for controlling costs that we identified has to do with the federal requirement that says school districts have to maintain their level of spending on special education from 1 year to the next. This is the so-called maintenance of effort requirement, and unless the school district does maintain its spending from year to year, except for certain circumstances, they will risk losing their federal funding. Now, if a school district's population of special education students goes down over from 1 year to the next, there is a variance for that. And there are a couple of other variances that are available. But for the most part, school districts do have to maintain their level of spending year to year over time.
Ms. Power, Representative Dornis has a question.
Mr. Chair, it kind of ties in with that comment about maintenance of effort. Can you tell me what the kind of the understanding was with the federal government? What share were they intending to pay for special education, and what? I mean, can you tell me what the number was? And I know you've indicated what the number is.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. Back when the legislation was first passed, so now we're talking about again decades ago, the federal government was saying that it would provide 40% of the revenues for special education costs. It has never approached 40% over the many, many years that the law has been in place. It is, as I said, for the last 12 years, been closer to the 11-12% range, than, and not anywhere close to the 40% that the federal government had originally stated it would provide.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, my only point is that we need to be careful when we rely on the federal government for help.
Ms. Hauer, kind of a little detailed question. So when I look at it, so I understand the metro area regional centers, you know, bigger school districts can offer, you know, more services. I suspect there are, you know, families that will, you know, move and open enroll their students into those districts in order to avail themselves of that. But when you report out cross subsidies for all districts, are we looking at numbers only relative to the services that they're providing in that district, or are we also including the monies that follow their students into another district?
Mr. Chair, if I understand your question, it would be the total expenditures by the school district for the students receiving special education. So that means if a student was receiving education outside of the district where they resided, that's still the cost of that residential, the resident district, and that is, yes, so that's included as a part of that, the reported cross-subsidy.
Got it. So if you have a small school district, students, you know, perhaps not being able to provide the particular services the student has, student open enrolls into another district where they're able to get that, that's, when we talk about cross-subsidy, we are still talking about that smaller, in my example, school district, having to cover those costs, and that's factored into our understanding of their cross-subsidy costs.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's right. Now, there are different ways of reporting the cross-subsidy, but in the figures that I'm reporting to you today, it does include those children who are leaving their home district to receive their education in another district or in a charter school.
Got it. Okay. So Representative Bly has a question.
Can you tell me, does the maintenance of effort apply to the state money that schools get for special education?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Representative, Hall. Yes. The federal maintenance of effort requirement applies to all revenues coming into a school district. Okay. That includes the federal, state, and any locally raised money as well.
Okay.
All right. Ms. Hauer, please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move on to the recommendations that we suggest for the funding of special education. And one of our recommendations is that the legislature should consider options to reduce the school district reliance on the general education revenues for paying special education costs. We think this is needed to reduce the inequities in the current distribution of the cross-subsidy burden. Now, there isn't an easy way to do this. It most likely will involve raising additional revenue or to reduce that cross-subsidy burden, or shifting revenues from elsewhere to reduce that cross-subsidy burden. I wish we had some other viable option. Of course, one would be approaching the federal government and having it pony up the share that it originally said it would, but that doesn't seem quite as likely as some other possibilities.
Representative Nordis will probably lead that effort, no doubt.
In tandem with that recommendation, we think that it's important that the legislature and the Department of Education consider ways that school districts can rein in costs. Now, that's, of course, not necessarily easy either, given the disincentives we just talked about, particularly the maintenance of effort requirement. But despite those disincentives that are there, we spoke with some districts that are considering ways that they can try to control their costs. And we think the department should have a larger role in this. We think the department can help identify ways that would allow school districts to help control their spending and then assist districts in adopting some methods that perhaps some other districts have been exploring that seem to have worked for them. It would necessarily have to be measures that would allow the districts to continue providing appropriate services, that is, helping to educate the children that have the disabilities, but doing it in a way that would control some of the costs. We think at a minimum, the district could provide school districts with some data that would help them understand comparatively how they compare with some districts similar to them on certain things like their staffing patterns, and help them understand how that contributes to the costs that they have. We also recommend that the legislature consider changing laws that require the resident districts to pay the special education costs that are not reimbursed by the state for those students who enroll outside their resident district. Now, we don't recommend a specific percentage that we think those enrolling districts should pay. We do, though, caution against requiring a very large proportion being paid by the enrolling districts, because we think that for some districts it would prove to be a difficulty to continue to operate some of the special education programs they now have in place that are attracting some students to come to their district, while at the same time requiring them to pay for the students who come in from other districts. This would be especially difficult for the charter schools, who obviously don't have authority to seek an operating levy via a referendum, as would an independent school district. Mr. Chair, I'm going to move on to one of our next...
Howard, we have a couple questions. I apologize. Roger Erickson, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question. What is your background? Are you education by background, or just wondering?
Ms. Howard, I believe your question is to Ms. Howard.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative, my background is not in education. My background is as a researcher. I have a Master's of Planning from the Humphrey Institute of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. And really all of the staff in our office and our Program Evaluation Division are trained as evaluators, program evaluators. We don't have specializations in one area over another, but part of our, I think part of our benefits to the legislature and to others is that we can look at topics with kind of a third-party eye, looking at it independently without having biases that might otherwise enter into the evaluation. So my skill set, my background is all in the area of research and analysis and program evaluation.
Okay.
Representative Barry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to put in a plug for my districts, because they're part of, they banded together, including Representative Faust's areas, and created a St. Croix Regional Education District that manages, among other things, the special ed. Have you looked at that in particular as a way to control costs in Minnesota, and would you recommend potentially that working in other parts of the state?
Great
as well?
Question, Ms. Moore.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative. Yes, in fact, the education districts, the special education cooperatives, the service cooperatives around the state, we do describe them in Chapter 1 of our full report. They play a very important role in helping to provide special education services, and they do it in a way that allow districts to bring in some of the specialists that they need for perhaps one child or a small number of children who have a disability in a certain area, allows them to get that service without having to pay for that specialist all on their own. So a lot of times there might be an education district that has, let's say, 15 or 20 member school districts. Together, they have a body of students that require certain specialists that have their licensure for a given disability category that is then provided in a way that's much more cost-effective than if each district had to go out on its own to hire that specialist to provide the services to their individual students.
Thank you. Ms. Haar, let's do this. You have 6 slides before we get to the summary. Let's get through the 6. I'll note the questions, and then we'll come back at that point for questions. I just want to make sure we get all the important testimony in our 20 minutes that's remaining here.
Thank you, Mr.
Please
Chair.
Continue.
Then I'm going to turn to the comparison we made of legal requirements here in the state of Minnesota on special education versus the legal requirements at the federal level. We did find that there are many state statutes and rules that do exceed federal requirements on special education. About 42% of the statutes that we examined that pertain specifically to special education do contain provisions that exceed what's at the federal government level. And about 3/4 of Minnesota's rules on special education are specific to our state, not required federally. Now, of course, not all these requirements have the same impact. Some of them might apply, for instance, to just a certain disability category. On the other hand, some of the rules will apply to all school districts or all children. So, for instance, one of those that has is larger in scope is the requirement that Minnesota has that each school district hire a special education director. That applies to all districts and, of course, is much wider in scope than a rule that would apply to only a small proportion of all the children receiving special ed. Some of the requirements that are specific to Minnesota will affect what the special education teachers have to document. I want to give an example here. Every student, of course, receiving special education has this individualized education program, the IEP, that lays out what services are appropriate and needed for that child. Well, the federal government requires that the teachers write goals into the students' IEPs. Minnesota requires, in addition to that, that the teachers also write short-term objectives for each of the goals that are written in the IEPs. So we learned that the really voluminous paperwork required of special education teachers is a real component of their day-to-day lives, and Minnesota's requirements do contribute to this. In another area, requirements will affect timelines. One example here is the timeliness that's required when a school district will evaluate a child to determine eligibility for special education. Minnesota's rule says that this must be done in 30 school days. Federal requirements are 60 days. Some of the Minnesota-specific requirements apply to committees. Minnesota requires school districts to organize 3 committees that are not required at the federal level, and this includes parent advisory councils. Other requirements affect special education teacher caseloads. Right now, our state rules require that there is a certain number, a maximum number of students that can be assigned to a teacher when those students receive special education for at least half of their school day. Now, the number will vary by the type of disability. It also, that maximum number of students that can be assigned will also vary by the number of support staff that are in the classroom. And if you're interested in looking at the parameters of what the rule specifies, we do have an exhibit on page 92 of the full report that lays out what that ceiling is on the number of children that may be assigned to a special education teacher, depending on the disability category and the number of assistants in the classroom. And then there are a variety of other state-specific requirements that apply to many different things such as the methods that are available for resolving disputes when parents have disputes with the districts over what services are being provided, as well as just defining student eligibility for special education. Now, we spoke with a number of people as a part of our evaluation, educators, parents, others that showed us there's a real mixed view about the benefits and the drawbacks of Minnesota-specific requirements for special education. I'll give the one example about the parent advisory councils. Even that drew a real mix of responses from the people with whom we spoke. I mean, some people described to us how useful they found their parent advisory council. They thought it was a real benefit. Others came from some school districts where it was difficult to find enough parents who would even participate. and the districts didn't feel like they could entice a sufficient number of people to actually serve on the Parent Advisory Council, especially districts that are located in areas that are rural, that would require parents to travel 35, 40 more miles to participate in the council, or districts that didn't have any kind of financial support to offer to parents an incentive to participate, like reimbursing them for their mileage or providing daycare for their other children. So there were some difficulties in just the practical implementation of that requirement. So we also found that when we look for analyses of what the costs and the benefits were of Minnesota's requirements, the ones that exceeded the federal level, but we found that those, for the most part, just don't exist. Information really has not been compiled in a way that would allow us to determine what these legal requirements' impact is on either the economic cost or the educational benefit to the requirement. So consequently, you as legislators have very little data to weigh what the educational benefit is versus any cost that might be attributable to it. I'll go quickly over this next slide. We did find that some of the state's administrative rules are outdated. That is, they're not consistent with what state statutes require. I'll just describe one example to you. State statutes require that teachers begin planning for the students' transition out of high school when those students are in the ninth grade. So that's what the statute says. Ninth grade, the students planning for transition out of high school will begin. But one state rule requires that this planning begins when the student is at age 14, and a second rule specifies that the planning should begin instead when the student is either in ninth grade or age 14, whatever comes first. So we have this discrepancy between not only what's in the rules, but also between what the statutes say and what the rules say. And there are other examples that I won't go into today because of time considerations. I do want to point out, though, that, of course, statutes always supersede the rules. But even with that, we think it's important that they be consistent because people tend to turn to the statutes and the rules to understand what are the requirements they have to follow. And we think it can be quite confusing when the rules say one thing and the statutes say another. So in terms of the legal requirements, our recommendations are as follows. We recommend that to the extent that the legislature is going to be considering changing requirements, legal requirements for special education, that it would first direct the Department of Education to initiate some independent analyses of what are the economic costs and what are the educational benefits of the change that's being contemplated. But we think this is important and necessary for legislators to have an informed and be able to make an informed decision about whether things should change from the current set of requirements. You know, what is the effect on student outcomes, and how does that weigh against any efficiencies that might be gained? We also recommend that the Department of Education continue efforts that it has already begun to streamline some of the paperwork for special education teachers. Further, we recommend that the department evaluate the effectiveness of some of the strategies right now being contemplated by local districts around the state to reduce paperwork within their own district and then encourage other districts to adopt some of those same strategies that are proven to be successful. And then finally, we recommend that the department update its administrative rules regarding special education so that they are consistent with statutes. Mr. Chair, do we have time to go through the slides on compliance monitoring?
Please, please.
Okay, thank you. I mentioned already that the department is required by federal requirements to assure that school districts comply with all of the federal and state legal requirements. And to do this, the Department of Education here has a 5-year cycle for monitoring each one of the local education agencies. So for any given school district, within that 5-year cycle, the district will receive training from the department, and then it will conduct a self-review of a sample of its own files to determine that whether their paperwork can comply with the many requirements that they are required to follow. But as we spoke with teachers and as we spoke with special education directors in different parts of the state, we heard many complaints about the process, and particularly about compliance decisions that the local representatives thought were either inconsistent or based on trivial decisions. And we've been characterizing it as sort of a large disconnect between what is perceived of the compliance monitoring at the local level versus how the department perceives it. And let me give you one example of that. In one district we visited, we heard the teachers and the special education director there talk about monitors who had cited an IEP for a student because it had contained the phrase 7 out of 10 times in when referring to how student how they would measure whether a student met a goal, instead of using the phrase 70%. Well, we thought, you know, 7 out of 10 times versus 70%, they seem the same to us. How can the department be citing an IEP as out of compliance on that kind of language difference? Well, we spoke to the department about it, asked them about this kind of an example, and they told us that their monitors have not been instructed to cite for that kind of difference in phrasing. In fact, the monitors are instead trained to focus on, are those IEP goals measurable? And obviously, whether you look at 7 out of 10 or 70%, the goal is measurable. And they want the monitors are also trained to look at whether those goals are oriented toward the future of the student. The staff at the department also pointed out that it is the districts themselves, through that self-review process, who identify what documents are out of compliance or not. So, as I said, we saw a fairly large disconnect between how the department sees the process working and how those at the local level do. We did conclude that the monitoring process is a thorough one. It does help detect and make sure that noncompliance is corrected, but we do think it needs clarification to avoid some of the confusion that we saw as we talked to teachers and special education directors. So we recommend that the department evaluate its monitoring process to identify ways that it can improve teachers, special education teachers' understanding of what those legal requirements are and how what they have to do to meet them. We also think that the department should work with the staff out in the districts as well as their associations in a collaborative way to help identify some solutions that would avoid the confusion over what are the legal requirements and what has to be done to meet them. So with that, Mr. Chair, that's the summary of the report. My last slides just simply summarize what I've already said in terms of recommendations, which I can bypass if we have questions to answer.
Yeah, why don't we just have questions? The members say, and I, it would be ideal to have the department respond, but I don't think we're going to have the time to do that. I do want to direct members, if you haven't already, to the back of the report. Where you've got the department responding to the series of recommendations, and that's a typical format of a legislative auditor's report, where you would then have the auditor that provides an opportunity for the department to provide that kind of response. Obviously, this is a conversation that we're going to continue to have. I am particularly struck by the fact that we're spending $1.8 billion, and I think, is that both state and local?
Mr. Chair, that's the total pie of all revenues, the $1.8
billion. Yeah, so we're spending $1.8 billion per year, and we really don't have a modern or independent cost-benefit analysis of that work. We're obviously doing a lot of work in compliance, and there's obviously issues there, you know, with compliance, but it seems to me that while compliance is certainly vitally important, it's important also for us to be able to have, as policymakers, not just whether or not we have a good system of complying with the law, but whether or not the law is accomplishing what it is that we want to accomplish and doing so in an efficient manner as we deploy the people's resources. I kind of served up a softball to you, Mr. Noble, the last committee hearing relative to our ability to make some tough decisions around here relative to, you know, some of the key factors here. You've all gotten a taste of that in the recent week or so when we acted on some special ed legislation and amendments in this committee. Representative Erickson, you've been a part of these discussions for many years as Representative Dabney and some others. It requires, in my words, a very tough look at ourselves as legislators in the mirror to be able to be as independent as possible relative to the kind of pressures and expectations that we have from constituencies around special ed. And in order to do that, it certainly would be, I think, highly beneficial to have independent analysis that provides us with a look at cost-benefit perspectives that we can at least fall partly back on in terms of making some of the tough decisions here. Otherwise, I think we're just going to constantly be yanked and pulled according to, you know, our strong desires to, you know, respond positively to people who are dealing with some very tough issues trying to raise their children. So with that, Representative Krisha Barrett Erickson, let's see if we can do this in 5-4 minutes. Yes, Sandra.
Thank you, Chair Mariani.
And Roger Harrison as well.
And just very quickly, as I look at all the recommendations in all the years that you've been doing this, how seriously does the legislature consider your recommendations?
Mr. Chair, I think that the legislative auditor, Jim Nobles, is probably in a better position to answer that question.
And I would say, first of all, we feel very good about the fact that you give our report serious consideration, such as with this report, the second hearing. I'm sure we'll have many more. We sometimes deliver to you some really difficult issues. You know, unlike in our financial audit division, we can go off and find problems and make recommendations, and they can typically be implemented by the administration. We actually typically don't make recommendations to the legislature in our financial audit division, but we have this program evaluation division, which, by the way, Representative Erickson, is 12 really talented staff. And I think one of the ways in which we deliver these reports to you is that you give us five or six topics to go off and evaluate each year, and I put together a team, usually two or three people, and they go out for a considerable period of time, and that's all they think about. And they work, they think, they dream, they are consumed, ultimately, by this topic. And then they deliver this report, and that's how we get it done. And so there is a considerable investment of staff time and resources. And so I think they should be given serious consideration, and I'm happy to report that they are. But getting to the implementation of the legislative recommendations is often very trying and difficult. Representative Mariani can, for example, testify to you, I'm sure, about the challenge of implementing the recommendations we made on integration revenue, which is another topic dear to the hearts of members of this committee and the Finance Committee. Very, very difficult to do. We typically make recommendations that touch a lot of interests. And as with this report with special education, and I made the comment to the Finance Committee that on many of these issues, you will not find consensus among the people who are interested and concerned, and they are very passionate. And so ultimately, you are going to have to make some tough decisions about what direction to go, particularly on the state going beyond the federal mandates, because there are interest groups that have fought hard over many years to get those additional state requirements that go beyond federal. And as you try to address those, there will be a considerable amount of concern and sensitivity and anxiety. So, again, in answer to your question, we feel very good working with you as the legislature, as legislative committees, and the consideration that you give our reports. We really need to have an understanding, and I think we do, of just how difficult it is for you to deal with some of the issues that we bring to you, though. So I will say at the end of that, thank you for this hearing and many others where you've given us very serious consideration.
We do have a few other questions. Let's try to squeeze these in here. Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see that Representative Erickson Sandra has taken off her gloves, literally, not figuratively. I'm wondering if she could borrow them to me. But my question, though, Mr. Nobles, is you've probably seen the article by the local paper about a large amount of money spent for special ed for a particular child. Was that due to state mandate or a federal mandate, and can that be easily rectified by decisions we make here at the Capitol?
Mr. Nobles.
Well, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Hauer may want to comment as well, but Representative Barrett, I think that was a very interesting article. I think it was good. It put kind of a human face on some of these issues. We give you a lot of data. We don't necessarily get down into personal stories, and I think it's useful for you to know those personal stories. Those school districts made those decisions to meet the legal requirements, either federal or state, in the way that they did. There is obviously a great deal of controversy, again, within the special education community, because what that article highlighted was that to serve some children, it's very difficult to serve them in a normal classroom, to mainstream them. And so some schools have provided kind of extraordinary settings and facilities to do what they consider in the best interest of those students. And some parents feel that too. But clearly there are people in the special education community that feel that is not the direction to go. And not just because of the cost, but because of the potential isolation and segregation of those children.
Representative Erickson will have the last question, but I do want to pass along Mr. Rick Keller's request that the report be available in a fully accessible way for constituents who are, I believe, the term is print disabled, and so perhaps that might be an offline conversation about that. Representative Erickson, you get the final word.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a question. I just have a compliment to the Office of the Legislative Auditor and to Jody Hauer and her team. I find this special education audit to be one of the best that has been done in the area of education. Comprehensive and gives us so much information that I think we'll be able to think very thoughtfully about reforms, about suggestions that they have delivered to us. So thank you very much, OLA.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could just say, too, thank you to Representative Erickson. She is a long-standing member of the Legislative Audit Commission, works very diligently in that role. So we certainly appreciate the contributions that she has made over the years.
I echo both of those comments. And members, let's put our heads together during the interim in particular and see what kind of further vetting we can do as legislators on this issue. There are some pieces of legislation are moving forward to also do some vetting, creating some task forces to do that. But none of that bars us from being able to continue this conversation in the months to come. So, Ms. Howard, thank you. Excellent work. Mr. Nobles, as usual, very good work. Excellent work. Thank you for being with us here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Members, this committee stands adjourned.
Thank you.